My great discovery of today is lapel mic is back working again. Hopefully, everyone is hearing in the back row. Excellent. We acknowledge collaborators here. Lisa Jones is the epidemiologist on the study. Lorraine Sinnott and Lynn Mitchell. Mel Mushberger provide statistical support. And Carla Zadnick is the principal investigator for the Arinda longitudinal study of myopia and the CLEAR study. I think one of the interesting things about this symposium is often you think of human clinical data as being very noisy, very inconclusive. One study says this, one study says that. What are we supposed to come away from here? And I think one of the interesting things about what you've heard this morning is hopefully a consistency of message. So what's our message? The circumstantial evidence case surrounding near work, I don't think you could build a better case out of circumstantial evidence. We've heard allusions to changing myopia prevalence over time, that there are these occupational differences where myopes are more commonly found in occupations requiring more near work or more study, that when you actually measure near work activities, that myopes are spending more time doing it. And there's certainly a huge body of evidence from animal studies that point in the same direction as what human children are doing, that hyperopic defocus is a bad thing, and that myopes show more hyperopic defocus. Jane's group finds it a couple of years before the onset of myopia. We at least see it after the onset of myopia. So everything is there and in place to indict near work. And what fascinated me is, as I said at the beginning of the symposium, is that these large international clinical studies are starting to weigh in on whether the near work as the bad actor is actually a risk factor for the onset of myopia. And as Sengmei has published in their 3 years of follow-up, reasonable things like parental myopia and IQ, as she's alluded to, turned up as risk factors for onset, but there was not significantly increased risk of onset from these various near work activities, either individually or in their aggregate. Cross-sectionally, as has been said many times, these protective effects, though, from outdoor activities have been shown to be significant. And actually, it's sort of across a wide range of levels of sophistication of asking the question. I admire greatly Kathy Rose's the City Myopia Studies very extensive questionnaires, and Sang Mae has had also very extensive questionnaires about outdoor activities. Ours is sort of medium level in terms of sophistication. This Onal study of Turkish medical students, it was fairly easy to find the protective effect of outdoor activity. I think their question was along the lines of, did you play a lot outdoors before the age of 7? And this protective effect was found in their study. There are nice animal parallels here too in terms of distance fixation, interfering or interrupting periods of hyperopic focus. There's this very uneven level of integration of visual signals, so there's a good case there for outdoor activity. Outdoor activity, at least the physical part, as we saw at ARVO, was not a significant factor, but there was a hint in this cross-sectional study that outdoor activity, or the leisure portion of outdoor activity in this cross-sectional study was a significant, it was something that was found more often in non-myopes than myopes. And as I said to my students, if you combine that with Dick Stone's findings on nicotine, the best thing that you could do perhaps to prevent the onset or prevent myopia is hang out by the pool and have a smoke. We can trade lung cancer and skin cancer for the scourge of myopia. But perhaps not. We'll talk a little bit more about what's the best way perhaps to deliver this dose. So we wanted to look in our longitudinal study now, getting out of sort of cross-sectional associations and looking back again at the risk of onset. What do our data from the Arinda longitudinal study of myopia have to say about near work and outdoor sports activities and the risk of onset? And I should point out, these have been published, so I'll review them briefly and leave time for discussion. These are third graders, about 8.5 years old, participating in our study over a long period of time. And over this interval, we had over 100 become myopic by or before the eighth grade. And these are going to be compared to 400 or so who remain non-myopic by their eighth grade visit. This is the survey question that was asked, which is during the school year, so ignoring summer activities, perhaps an important period for physical or outdoor activities. How many hours per week would you estimate your child engages in each of these activities? And parents would fill in their best guess on hours per week. We do this sort of weighting of the hours into this diopter hours variable with some sort of paying some sort of respect to the different distances at which children perform these activities. The closest activities get a multiple of 3, intermediate activities 2, and television a little bit further away gets a 1. I have to say, though, this weighting scheme and paying attention to distance has not been productive and very meaningful for us. Unweighted or weighted hasn't been so different. However, looking at Kathy Rose's recent paper again and some of Jane's results about the closeness or the importance of distance at which the activity takes place, perhaps this needs to be given closer attention. And the hours that you'll see are hours per week. So these are the basic findings in the comparison of the non-myopic column to the became myopic column. So this is remained non-myopic. These are third grade numbers, all numbers in the third grade, and these are children who eventually crossed over into myopia. And you can see they're already closer to the myopic cliff. But as we look at how many hours different on average between the two at the third grade level, it's on the order of about three and a half or so. And that we have a significant odds ratio here on the protective direction, and that none of these close-work variables were different between the groups who were going to remain non-myopic or become myopic. So of all the environmental variables we see, as has been shown many times in this symposium so far, that it seems that it's outdoor activities is the relevant environmental exposure rather than the near work activities. Parents are still looking like a significant risk factor. You see that no myopic parents are overrepresented here for the children who remain non-myopic, and having two myopic parents are overrepresented for children who eventually become myopic with these odds ratios. Putting those into some sort of final model, we have, again, significant odds ratios for myopic parents, protective odds ratio for sports and outdoor activities, and no significant odds ratio for reading in terms of myopia risk. This is, again, risk of onset. So this to me is the key or relevant figure from the paper presenting the picture of these risk factors of parental myopia and the relevant environmental exposure together. And you see the hereditary environment interaction that we talk about, but it doesn't seem to be near work. It seems to be this outdoor activity. So you can see what we've got here is 0, 1, or 2 myopic parents. The dotted lines are the 2 myopic parents. So you can see the effect of myopic parents in each group here, that the chance of becoming myopic increases with the number of myopic parents. And what's on the x-axis are quartiles of the outdoor sports activities, all the way from children doing next to nothing here, 0 to 5. And this is our highest activity group. The quartile starts with greater than 14 hours per week. So you can see the effect of myopic parents, as I said, as these bars, these are 95% confidence intervals here on these probabilities. Myopic parents increase your chances of becoming myopic in each group. You can see the effect of sports with a downward slope as the quartiles increase. But what strikes me here is sort of the magnitude of this effect. Looking at just a couple of relevant bars here, if we're about a 0.6 here, if you're not doing much outdoor sports activities and you have two myopic parents, the suggestion here is that you can cut that rate down to about 0.2 or something like that if children engage in this level of sports activities, or if you're in a lower risk group with no myopic parents, that you're at about 0.3, and this decreases to something like 0.1 or so if you have a high level of sports activities. I mean, this seems to be about the most interesting environmental effect that I've seen in the myopia literature, and I'm impressed that it seems to be consistent across different sites and different ethnicities. If this is sort of mid-level, it suggests that maybe a dose would be something on the order of, if this is the mid-level at 10, and we need to get up to about 14, something like an increase on the average child of an hour per week, or total that something like children should be engaged in about 2 hours per day to get the effect. Not quite sure what's implementable in terms of, since children are spending most of their time, as they should, in an educational environment, what we can ask schools to do. But it's disturbing that we're, I think, in a poor direction in terms of myopia, if this is in fact a real effect. Statistics in Ohio, for example, are pretty pitiful in terms of the number of schools. I think the percentage is perhaps under 10% of schools require some sort of compulsory physical education in elementary schools. And this just seems completely wrong-headed and not very useful. So looking back again to older data, but cross-sectional data, this points out to me something very curious in this near work and outdoor activity discussion. And that is, cross-sectionally we see, myopic parents are important again. Sports looks protective. Myopes, when they're myopic, are also doing fewer sports or outdoor activities than non-myopes. So we're not in the protective domain. We're describing what myopes and non-myopes do. And myopes are doing fewer hours of this sort of activity. What we see here is that we've got a significant odds ratio here for the amount of near work that myopic children are doing when they're myopic. But it's not apparently a risk factor for the onset of myopia. So I think I heard it expressed, is the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. It's sort of our cognitive or IQ variable. And that is also significantly related, that myopes tend to score better on these achievement tests. But what I want to point out, and I think I heard Leslie express it, is sort of, are the risk factors for progression the same or different than the risk factors for onset? And I think this is an indication that maybe that they are, in that children who are non-myopic, and you look at risk factors for onset, we see sort of no significant effect for near work, but then once they become myopic, they seem to be doing more near work. So this maybe suggests a behavior change, and I point you to poster 18, which is what Lisa is presenting in poster form here. And that's exactly what we see, is that the difference between what pre-myopes and emmetropes do in terms of near work is very similar. But once they become myopic, then myopes tend to do slightly more near work. So the associations that remain for us to debate in near work and myopia, maybe we should be thinking about how the onset of myopia changes some children's behavior. So sort of to summarize, we don't find that near work is a risk factor for the onset of myopia. We do find, and then reported cross-sectionally, that once you're myopic, though, you do tend to do more near work. We do see protective effects for myopia onset for sports and outdoor activities. So, questions for discussion, since we're headed into the discussion time. One that I haven't heard expressed is, do we still think that this sports and outdoor activity effect is actually real, or could it be potentially confounded by something else? Like, is there some intrinsic difference between a kid who's inclined to do more sports activities compared to one who isn't, in terms of personality or something that's related to myopia, like whatever we mean by IQ, some sort of aptitude or cognitive variable? And if we adjusted for that, could we make the sports effect go away? I don't know. The associations between personality and myopia aren't all that strong, so it's difficult to think of that completely confounding away what appears to be a very robust and consistent effect, but it's something worth considering. As Kathy mentioned at the outset, what exactly are the relevant activities? Perhaps it's not physical exertion and raising your heart rate or some sort of level of fitness. Perhaps it's simply getting out of your chair and getting outdoors and exposing yourself to whatever. You know, can ultraviolet actually be that good for us in that regard? If it is getting outdoors, how does this work? What exactly is the magic that links ultraviolet to the growth of the eye and actually gets us a shorter axial length? I'm intrigued by what Kathy said about retinal dopamine. At least then we're talking about something at the level of the eye that we think might be able to control eye growth. And as we all read papers, write papers, review papers, it's sort of crept into the literature as kind of a tagline truism that myopia is genetic and environmental. That sounds quite reasonable. However, it's been quite acceptable for quite some time that the relevant main exposure for the risk of the onset of myopia is near work. Perhaps we our discussion and our vocabulary should move away from genes and environment. By environment, we all mean near work, to perhaps genes and environment, and by environment, maybe we're thinking about outdoor and sports and physical activities. So let me acknowledge my funding sources and thank you very much.